Well, welcome to the court. We're ready to hear argument in Christian versus Counseling Resource. Are you ready to proceed? Very well.
May it please the court, I'm Al Gretto. I'm here as local counsel for Ms. Christian and the Christian family, as well as the estate of Bruce Christian. Before I have the pleasure of introducing Pro Hoc Counsel, Mr. Heleniak, I wanted to make sure I addressed the court as I addressed Ms. Christian on the issue of my letter of February 4th to her, to the court below, regarding my request to address the trial scheduling order. I recognize that the trial scheduling orders should be, modifications should be sought via motion. I recognize that. I also recognize that there's a civil case management plan out of Superior Court in Newcastle County that says to file that motion. I have to notice it 10 days, at least 10 days out. And given the time constraints where we were, counsel and I getting into the case late, we were already overdue. I conferred with my colleagues. We figured that was the best way to approach the issue. And so I did file or send a letter to the court asking to address the issue. The court was very clear in a teleconference from Chambers to me, as well as in a letter to counsel February 8th, that the TSO was not going to be changed. That scheduling order was set. It was set a long time ago, and it wasn't going to be changed. Given the time constraints where we were in the TSO, the fact that January 3rd was the deadline for the experts, we had an informal arrangement with counsel who was very cooperative with us to the best of their abilities to continue on, and that's why I did what I did. I just wanted to make sure that the court
Us that in addition to your letter, somewhere between your letter and the court's letter, there was a teleconference?
Yes, the day after, I think it was February 7th, Your Honor, I received a call from Chambers. It was very clear that those dates were not going to be changed. So,
When you say you received a call, is this a conference call with all counsel on the call?
No, it was not. It was a call from Chambers to me in my office.
Who called you from Chambers? Was it an ex parte conversation with the judge?
One of the support staff, Your Honor.
All right, so my question for you is, when you got the letter from the judge, she clearly construed your letter as a request to continue the trial. She said we're keeping the trial date. And after that, you didn't write back and say, fine, we'll live with the trial date, but we need a new scheduling order for discovery. Did you?
Actually, Your Honor, in the second paragraph of my letter to the court at A76.
No, I'm talking about the Superior Court letter in response to that. Did you ask for a new scheduling order?
I did that in my letter of February 4th, Your Honor.
And what was the response to that?
By telephone, no, and by letter February 8th, no, those dates are set. They will not be changed. And I felt it would have been contemptuous to file a motion at that point. I was directed by the court that those dates were set, and I didn't want to offend the court below.
Very well.
And I did what I did.
Thank you.
Thank you. With great pleasure, I introduce Mr. Heleniak.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a privilege to be here, to appear before the court, and I appreciate the privilege of doing so and of representing the Christians. Because of the concern expressed by the court, the letter order of the court below was very clear that it wasn't just the trial dates that weren't going to be changed. It was that trial scheduling order and all the dates therein. And I understand the procedural issues and certainly respect them. However, the procedure that Mr. Gretto utilized in attempting to get the court's attention, to have a conference with the court, to bring the issues and to negotiate them in a forum that would allow all parties to have input and to come to some intelligent and reasonable new scheduling order, given all of the issues that had come before.
Well, don't you have to sort of lay out some kind of just cause in the application itself, or not? Or is it your contention that was explained?
It's my contention that in Mr. Gretto's letter to the court, he indicated that counsel withdrew on behalf of the plaintiff because of a conflict, that new counsel was entering, both local counsel and Pro Hac Vici counsel. At the time of Mr. Gretto's letter, I was not yet admitted. I was admitted thereafter in order to provide more flexibility in scheduling in this case to try to move it along, and I eventually took over completely handling it. But one of the main purposes for me getting involved so that we could move this case along in recognition of the status of it. The Christians in this case...
But do you recognize that substitution of counsel in and of itself is not a basis for a postponement?
I recognize that that is mentioned in the case law, yes. But what I also recognize and would like the court to recognize is that the court is, of course, made up of rules to keep order, to have the orderly progression of the litigation. The court also is to be there for litigants to air their claims and to have their day in court. And that certainly is a policy in this state to have the courts.
You know, before we get to policy, we have a legal issue.
Yes.
And the legal issue is whether the court abused its discretion in not imposing some sanction, some lesser sanction other than the sanction of dismissal. So I have two questions.
Yes.
Number one, since that has to be your position, what lesser sanction are you telling us the court should have imposed in the proper exercise of discretion? That's number one. And number two, at the time that you in your office entered its appearance, were you not aware, at the very least, that there was a risk that you would have to go to trial on the stated trial date and you would be bound by the discovery deadlines that were already enshrined in the court's prior order?
Second question first. Certainly, I was aware when we reviewed this matter and made a decision to get involved on behalf of the Christians that there was an August 1, 2011 trial date. And certainly, I recognized that that could be held.
Okay, and you also recognized, I gather, that there were discovery deadlines that were still in place, notwithstanding Mr. Greco's earlier attempt to get those moved.
Yes. What we had was okay. Discussions with prior counsel.
Well, the answer is yes, you knew.
I was, when I got involved...
Either you knew or you didn't.
Not specifically of the date. Prior counsel turned over his file to us, the trial scheduling order was not among the materials that was turned over to us.
At some point you learned about it, didn't you?
I learned after the deadline had passed, yes.
You didn't know that before?
I did not know the January 3rd deadline for providing expert reports was in place until after it had passed.
All right. Let's get to the first question, the lesser sanction.
Yes. I would submit to the court that because the situation is not one where either the plaintiffs or counsel just out-and-out disregarded orders.
The lesser sanction, what is it?
None was considered by the court below.
What did you ask the court to do? That is, didn't you ask the court at some point when you were facing dismissal that to apply some lesser sanction?
I suggested to the court that a lesser sanction, even a monetary fine on counsel, if a sanction was deemed appropriate, could be used. The purpose of the sanction in this case of dismissal, certainly the purpose of making a sanction on counsel is not served by dismissing the plaintiff's case.
I understand that. And what are you arguing to us that the lesser sanction or sanctions should have been?
I'm arguing that there wouldn't necessarily be a sanction to be imposed because under the considerations of the Drejka case and others, there weren't the elements here that required a sanction. However,
isn't that equivalent to arguing something like a stop sign being slowed down?
We did not disregard court orders, Your Honor. we were put in a position where we had to represent a client with a meritorious claim under circumstances where we had attempted what we thought was the proper way to extend the deadlines. We were faced with a situation where we couldn't do that. We had to do whatever we could to represent these folks, to build their case up, and we had, for a time, the cooperation of defense counsel on the other side, who did work with us and who also were conducting discovery outside the parameters of the trial scheduling order as well.
Well, let's go back to Justice Jacobs' question. In considering other alternatives in the opinion, the Superior Court notes, the suit was filed 15 months before the court was ruling. The complaint was against Dr. Stone had been filed 16 months before that, and that a year before the court acted, they had set the August 1st trial date. And then the court goes on to talk about the delayed disclosure of the expert reports and the additional experts that were discovered, and that extending the date of the trial wasn't really an alternative for reasons discussed in the opinion. So now we're here on appeal. You're arguing that the Superior Court's decision should be reversed because the ultimate sanction of dismissing your case was too harsh. Our question is, what's the alternative? And so far your answer seems to be the court should have taken no action.
The court certainly could have taken an action to sanction, to assess costs for bringing in experts for depositions for the defendants, if that was an issue. The prejudice here to the defendants, we submit, was never established. So that, considering that, it's hard to imagine what the sanction should be here because we didn't blatantly or intentionally violate court orders. There were no orders entered to compel the expert reports or to compel additional answers to expert reports.
Yes, I want to be sure I understand your position on this. As an alternative sanction, then, the trial court could have ordered that any new expert that the defense had to hire or deposition costs relating to your late disclosed experts, all attorney's fees and costs relating to that could have been shifted to the plaintiff?
I'm not sure about fees for defense experts because it seems to me that there may be something in conflict with the plaintiffs paying for the defense experts. But certainly costs involved in taking plaintiffs' experts' depositions to bring them here so that they could be deposed more conveniently for the defendants, and to take away the timing or the assertion of prejudice. Yes, I could see that.
Now, one of the arguments that's also made is that the disclosures themselves provided a basis for summary judgment because you did not meet the legal standard for a wrongful death claim in Delaware.
I recognize that was raised in the briefs. It was not raised in argument in the court below. However, the argument, as I understand it, is that because the experts, who were an internal medicine family practice physician, a psychologist, mental health counselor, a psychiatrist, and an economic expert, an economist, did not use the words proximate cause. What they did in their reports is they gave their opinion to a reasonable degree of professional certainty that the, at least as far as the three physicians, that the defendants breached the standard of care, and they were very specific in the disclosures to indicate how that standard was breached, and they were very specific to indicate that the breaches by the respective family physician defendant and the counselor defendant contributed to the cause of the injuries to Mr. Christian.
Well, that may be a difference in words, but words matter, don't they? I mean, it would have been just as easy to say, but for the alleged negligence of the provider, there would have been no injury.
But, excuse me, in Green versus Wiener, it's it's clear that magic words or specific words are not required in an expert report or expert disclosure. The expert disclosures were made to convey the words and opinions of the specific medical and physician experts. And they are not bound to use legal terms. It's for a jury to determine whether their opinions, as expressed on cause, fits the legal definition of proximate cause as is given to them by the trial judge.
We recognize that the issue of whether or not these affidavits stated a cause of action, so to speak, is not before us. I think the point that the other side was making was that with affidavits worded that way, that alerted them to the possible need to take the depositions of these experts to determine whether or not they had an opinion, a causation opinion that would survive a motion for a directed verdict. And there was only 3 weeks to go before the trial. So the question then was, how are they to do that and then get that issue briefed either in a Daubert hearing or in some other in limine procedure in time for the trial?
The issue of the depositions, the requests were made even as the negotiations were underway as to when the reports would be provided. The deposition requests were made almost out of form by the defendants. I recognized that the reports were beyond the deadline, that they were coming up on the trial date, and I agreed that they could depose the experts without any motion for cause or anything like that. And those negotiations to set those dates started when the reports were provided.
Well,
two of the reports were provided within the time that in Drejka the court recognized that reports provided more than 2 months before the trial date would give adequate time to take the depositions of experts and to resolve any issues such as that.
That's two out of four.
That is correct. One of those, the third expert, who's the economist, his deposition was not requested by the defendants. And the fourth, the report was delayed because initially the plaintiffs were not looking at a psychiatric expert, but the defendants had identified one. And in response, the plaintiffs felt the need to consult with one, and indeed it was a causation expert from a psychiatric standpoint whose opinions could be formed and were pertinent to the case. So that expert was identified later in the game, but for the same reasons that the others were late, that there was discovery.
Where are you going to with all this? The undisputed fact is that by the time all this was done, there were 3 weeks left to take whatever depositions were needed and to engage in whatever motion practice was indicated.
No, the psychiatrist report was provided on June 9th. The trial date was set for August 1.
So your point is that even though you were 5 months late, all told, your side, it was the fault of the defendants for not adapting to that and going at warp speed to complete the depositions and then whatever motion practice was indicated before August 1st.
No, my point is that the plaintiffs were put in an untenable position to try to establish their case with new counsel coming in at the last minute after discovery had not been pursued for months because of withdrawing counsel and his conflict.
Does the record show that when Mr. Rhodes determined there was a conflict, that essentially the case was in suspended at that time, that there was no discovery, no nothing was happening?
The record shows that the last thing that Mr. Rhodes did was in June, I believe it was, file a motion to consolidate the actions, and then the next thing that he apparently did in August was tell the plaintiffs that he had a conflict and they either had to find new counsel or drop their case, and also told them, by the way, I can't find any other Delaware counsel to take your case.
You're in your rebuttal time, but I want to ask you a question. The court dismissed the case for the reasons that are stated in the opinion, but along the way, the court addresses the fact that you seemed not to be in compliance with the informal agreement that had been reached between counsel independent of the court. Is it your position that you were in complete compliance with the informal agreement that you had reached with opposing counsel?
There had been an informal agreement before my involvement.
I'm only talking about after you got in the case.
After I got into the case.
Counsel agreed that we're going to go forward. My question to you is, from your perspective, were you in complete compliance with the informal discovery agreement you had reached with opposing counsel?
I complied to the best of our ability, certainly with respect to three of the experts who were identified in May. I will grant you that the expert identified in June was beyond that agreement. However, there are reasons for that, as I explained to the court, and any prejudice that I respect the scheduling of the court, the court's right to schedule it, but the prejudice that is rendered upon the plaintiffs in dismissing their case rather than changing a deadline or even changing a trial date is much greater to the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs are clearly injured persons with a meritorious claim who have been put out of court because of an immovable date that was set before their counsel got involved, before the cases were even consolidated and brought together, a date that was set without even input from all of the parties in the counsel that were eventually involved in the case.
Well, you have about 40 seconds of the time you reserved.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Ballinger on behalf of the appellees, Dr. Stone and Abbey Family Practice. The issue before the court today is whether it's within the trial court's discretion to order dismissal of a complex medical malpractice or medical negligence case where the plaintiffs identify expert witnesses 5.5 months after the court-imposed deadline and only 6 weeks before trial. Almost every scheduling order issued by the Superior Court these days bears the words that failure to meet the deadlines, absent good cause shown, will likely or may or can result in the court refusing to allow extensions regardless of the consequences. For that warning to have impact and for trial court scheduling orders to be respected, the court must have...
What is the case law or the rule specifically say about when a trial date can be rescheduled? Is it good cause, manifest injustice? What's the standard?
It's to change a trial date or to change a scheduling order, the standard is good cause.
No matter what's in the scheduling order itself?
I would think that the court would still have discretion under the good cause standard to say even if you've shown good cause, there's something else in the scheduling order that trumps that the court has ordered you to comply with that you haven't complied with.
Now, the other side said this was an immovable trial date. Is that correct or not?
The trial judge felt that was the case, that the trial date was immovable.
No matter what?
No matter what. And from the trial court's...
That means even with good cause, the trial date is immovable.
That was the trial court's... That was the trial court's position, although I have to say that on the record, the trial court determined that there was not good cause to move the trial date.
Well, on that point, I'm a little hazy. Obviously, there were presentations in some form that were made to the trial court early in, 2011. Was there a formal briefing or adversary presentation on the issue of good cause, or was this sort of done on the fly, so to speak?
Well, there were two issues that the court confronted. One was the initial request, the letter request from Mr. Gretto to adjust the scheduling order. And there was the letter, and there was the response from the court on that. And
Let's stop there. Did the letter argue good cause or attempt to state facts that at least inferentially suggested good cause?
Your Honor, respectfully, I would suggest it did not. The letter did not address the specific issues that good cause entails, that the plaintiffs had been generally diligent up to that point, that the need for more time was neither foreseeable or their fault, and that substantial risk of unfairness would occur if there was no change to the schedule. That's the information that the trial court needed to make.
Did the docket reflect that discovery had been suspended?
To the extent that if the court looked at the docket, there was no activity, it did, but there was no formal agreement, Your Honor, to suspend discovery. Nothing had occurred in several months. That's correct. But the letter to the...
And that's because the counsel of record or prior counsel of record believed he had a conflict.
Correct. And believed that his clients... Well, the record reflects that he advised them several months before the August letter he sent to them. That's included in the letter itself. And it also reflects that after that time, he thought that there was a transition that was occurring with regard to the file that did not occur.
Is it your position he should have proceeded and continued to actively engage experts, proceed with the litigation, notwithstanding the conflict?
Prior counsel's responsibility would be to continue to manage the case and do what's necessary until the court excuses him. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, just to get back for a moment to the good cause issue, were there any other communications to the court that attempted to demonstrate good cause other than Mr. Greco's letter?
There was not, and that's an important point. After the court denied that request, which was made on insufficient information, the plaintiffs then had a choice. They could have filed for re-argument. They could have said to the court, we think there's important information here we neglected to put in our original letter that the court needs to know to make a reasoned decision. Here it is. But they chose instead a different path, which was just...
I'm confused whether we're talking about the same letter. The letter that I have in front of me, dated February 4th, says the purpose of the letter is to request a conference.
Yes.
To discuss all of these issues. Now, admittedly, it wasn't in the form of a motion, but at least it's an invitation or request for a dialogue with the court, and it even mentions you have a conflict, you know, with a trial date at the end that the court subsequently denied. But I'm confused about how we get to writing a letter that says we have some issues, we'd like to meet with the court to discuss them, to saying the letter was deficient because it didn't demonstrate good cause, when the intent of the letter seems to be, if you give us an opportunity to meet with the court, we'll tell you about our good cause.
Well, I think that the plaintiffs had an obligation, Your Honor, to explain to the court that the seriousness of the situation they were in. At the point they were asking to contact the court, the expert deadlines in the scheduling order were already passed, and they needed to alert the court to the seriousness of the issue. They had an opportunity to do that afterwards as well, when the court denied the request to modify the scheduling order.
Well, that's what's confusing. Justice Holland correctly pointed to the February 4th letter. Was there any follow-up written presentation or letter in any form by the other side to the court in an effort to affirmatively show good cause?
There was not, Your Honor, until the defendants filed their motion to preclude the experts. And then the issue was joined once again several months later.
That was in the summer, correct?
That was in the summer, correct. So there was nothing in between February and June from the plaintiffs to alert the court to the fact that, and I don't mean to make light of it, though, that they were driving a train going 100 miles an hour, headed towards another train, and there was going to be a crash. And
or
the letter they sent
or at least a concrete wall.
Well, yeah. Or at least a concrete wall. The letter they sent to the court, I would respectfully suggest, was something along the lines of, it's a little hot in our car, could we crack a window or pull over and check the air conditioning?
Okay.
And
just,
the court,
just so I understand your position, then, you're saying that the only communication to the court was a letter by Mr. Greco in February that requested a conference. It didn't purport to demonstrate good cause. It simply was a request for a conference. That was turned down.
And
nothing else was done, even though there was an opportunity then to make a more formal presentation. Is that your position?
That's essentially correct, Your Honor. The letter did refer to certain issues with counsel's ability to comply with the scheduling order, and it mentioned that in the context of prior counsel's withdrawal.
Well, it didn't say that exactly. It said, unfortunately, we're in noncompliance. And then the letter concludes that one counsel opposes changing the trial date, but they don't oppose changing the scheduling order. So they're in this very letter that talks about the conference, says there may be a problem with the trial date, but there's definitely a problem with the scheduling order because we're already out of compliance. And at least both sides are willing to talk about the scheduling order if we don't move the trial date. But notwithstanding, the court was on notice, this was the purpose of the conference. The court said, no conference, see you on August 1st.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would just say that from the perspective of a busy trial judge trying to manage hundreds of trains headed toward their destination, that if you want to get the court's attention, you need to be explicit about the problem and how serious it is. And if the first time you try, you're unsuccessful, then you try again. And say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I don't think you understand. This is a very serious matter. Our expert deadlines have already expired, and we are months away from being able to identify experts. This has to do with the fact that there was a hiatus in the case as a result of counsel's withdrawal. And
yeah,
at that point,
in response to that letter, the trial judge wrote, the fact that plaintiffs chose to engage new counsel is not a valid basis for the court to reschedule these longstanding dates. Is that factually accurate? And would a conference have demonstrated to the trial judge that the plaintiffs didn't choose anything? This was thrust upon them?
No and yes. No, it's not factually accurate. They did not choose it. A conference probably or a follow-up letter to the court would have explained that. However, at the same time, even if that's all the plaintiffs were going to argue about, Rule 90 specifically says that withdrawal of an attorney from a case is not proper grounds for relief under the rules. And so based on that alone, the court would still be within its discretion to say that the current schedule stands.
It's never a ground? Is that what the rule says? It's never a ground?
No. I would have to look at the rule again to be sure, but I have it here.
Let's go while you're – go ahead. See if you can find the rule.
Oh, back here. Withdrawal of an attorney ordinarily will not be considered as permissible grounds for delay and relief under these rules.
So it can be.
It can be.
Mr. Ballinger, one of the problems that we have is the issue of whether or not there was an abuse of discretion may depend in part upon what time in the cycle of events we're focusing on. If you're focusing on the period 6 weeks before the trial, then one could get to one result. But if the focus is back in February, when perhaps all of this could have been avoided had the court simply scheduled a conference so that all of these issues could be aired, then that may point to a different result. How are we supposed to evaluate, how are we supposed to address that problem?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that although the court's response to the request for a dialogue was curt, that the plaintiffs had ample opportunity at that point to still to get the court's attention on this issue, and that they contributed to that by the fact that the letter simply did not address the magnitude of the problem that the parties and the court ultimately were facing. And so the question is, with regard to February, is it within the court's discretion, based on the information before it in that letter, to rule that there's not going to be an adjustment of the schedule? And because the
all right, so you're saying that there would be no difference in the result because it was up to counsel to alert the court in a clearer way to the problem.
But correct. I would say it a little differently. I would say that based on the record before the court, it wasn't an abuse of discretion to deny the request that was made to adjust the schedule, which is the way the court interpreted the letter that it received.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Elzafan on behalf of Mr. Cannon and his professional association. On the matter that, picking up where we just left off, if we focus on February, I think it's important to note for all the facts that even as of February, the plaintiffs had two experts already retained. The expert against my client, Dr. Remorowski, was the one who filed the affidavit of merit way back, and he was part of the case, and there's nothing that would have prevented working with him to get it up. One of the experts named against Mr. Balaguer's client, Dr. Baker, was involved early as well. So even as of February, from February to August, to use the train analogy, it may make getting into the station a little tougher, but there's still plenty of time to get it done. And what we had, a situation where it was disclosed in June, and then the deposition dates to try and tease out the opinions, and they were thorough, but there's nothing like a sworn statement from an expert, were not available to less than 3 weeks before trial. One was the 21st, and one, I think, was the 19th. So we were faced with the first time we could really get their experts under oath.
You're talking about the two previously identified experts. When did you get the reports of those two experts?
Okay, I have my timeline here. The report of Dr. Romorowski was disclosed on June, May 4th, that's right. May 4th is Romorowski, May 12th was Dr. Baker, May 27th was Verzilli, who's the economist, and June 9th was Dr. Mack, the disclosure.
Now, when we're talking about remedies and alternatives to dismissing the case, you were obviously concerned about your ability to prepare for trial. And why couldn't the Superior Court judge have said, we're going to go to trial on August 1st with the two known previously identified experts, but there are going to be no new experts brought into the case at this time?
The Superior Court could have done that. Though the concept of discretion, as the Whaley Court said, doesn't say in each situation this must be done. It's not a lockstep procedure, as has been pointed out in all the various questions, like when His Honor said, what about this rule?
What's difficult about this case is we start with a January 3rd order of the court, and that was extended through the agreement of counsel through the end of January. And then after that, counsel were cooperating with one another, which is certainly in accordance with the high traditions of the Delaware Bar. Things seemed to get confused when new experts were identified. And all of this is laid out in the opinion. But my question is, why was it an appropriate remedy to say you can't present any experts, which meant the end of the case, as opposed to limiting it to the two that had been previously identified?
Without a simultaneous continuance of the trial, which was within her discretion, this still would have put the defense in a position where we were would have from January, July 21st for one of the experts and July 19th for the other to basically get it all done, Daubert motions, et cetera.
You're saying it because the other side wouldn't give you deposition dates that would allow you to depose the two earlier identified experts in time?
Wouldn't implies an intentional conduct, which I'm not going to go there, but it is a fact that the letter with deposition dates was mailed on June 24th. We got it about 3 or 4 days later. And the June 24th letter, which is B-35, the offer dates were July 21st and July 19th, and we fiddled with those.
Well, without implying any intent, the answer to my question is yes?
That's when we got the dates.
These were the dates offered for the two originally identified
experts? The two original, Romorowski was an original expert. B-35 offers Mack and Romorowski, and Mack is not one of the original two. Mack is the one who's identified.
Have the original two been deposed?
Nothing's been deposed. No one was ever deposed. So what happened was the depositions were noticed. Romorowski was noticed for the 20th. Mack was noticed for the 21st. Baker was noticed for the 19th. Those notices were filed on June 30th. And then the telephone conference occurred on July 8th, in which Judge Aylwin struck everything, and we vacated the notices.
Now, those notices were consistent with the informal agreement?
Well, when the notices were sent out, when we got the deposition dates in, we got the disclosures in, the joint motion for exclusion had already been filed, and we sent a letter back saying, we'll schedule depositions, but it's without prejudice to our motion to exclude because, you know, the court could have said no, in which case we would have needed the deposition dates. We were, in essence, moving on parallel tracks. We weren't sitting on our rights, so to speak.
So when did your informal agreement come apart, and what was the nature of the break that led you to file the motion?
The date we had for certain was an informal agreement to the end of July, end of January, and then we had the my email, which is A105, which talks about the need to get things done now. There was a teleconference shortly after that. Matter of fact, it was 3 days later. It's A441 is the reflection of it, in which there was discussions. And I don't recall whether there was any statement saying, I will get these in such and such a time. I don't believe, and if my recollection is wrong, I can state that the plaintiff's attorneys committed themselves to a date certain. We will have it in by such and such a date. It was, we're working on it. My recollection, we're working on it. We'll get it to you as soon as we humanly can. And then they started coming in seriatim. The thing which probably tipped the scales is some of the expert witnesses came in, at least one, Dr. Mack, came in after the motion in limine deadline. In fact, Judge Abelman originally wasn't going to entertain the motion, if I recall correctly. And John, Mr. Balaguer, point out the fact, Your Honor, could you at least rule on Dr. Mack because he's after the deadline? I mean, how could I file a motion to exclude when he was based on your order when the information came to me after my motion would be due? And that's when she decided to take everything into consideration as is reflected at the beginning of her July 8th teleconference.
But she did amend, in effect, the scheduling order to allow for summary judgment.
She allowed it, absolutely.
And that was past the deadline for any motion, your application?
Yes, and it's, of course, under 56BB. I think the court has that discretion to do that within the rules. And I have 22 seconds left and nothing to add because it's already in the brief. If the court has any more questions, I'm more than happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I appreciate the opportunity to address you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well.
Thank you. I think there's a little bit of confusion on this issue of whether there were previously...
Mr. Ballinger, I've forgotten. You had gone over your time, but since you're at the podium...
I apologize.
Go ahead.
About previously identified experts. There were no previously identified experts. These were experts that were in the affidavits of merit that were filed that typically the defendants wouldn't see because they're under seal. In this case, they were filed not under seal. But we had no way to know that was going to be the experts they were going to use at trial until they filed the expert disclosures. So there really weren't any previously identified experts. The other issue on informal agreement, the only informal agreement that there was to extend to January 31, the expert deadline. After that, it was just a matter of dialogue and forbearance. And we made it clear in our discussions that the plaintiffs were dealing with a judge who was known for strictly construing and enforcing scheduling orders, and that we would do the best we could with them, but that as this dragged on, we were going to be put into a place where we were going to have to do something we didn't want to do.
Well, when you were dialoguing, was there a point where you told the other side, you or Mr. Elzafan or both of you, that if the other side didn't move more briskly in terms of offering deposition dates, that you had no choice but to file a motion to preclude?
In Mr. Elzafan's, what I call as in now, email, the email that was sent on April 24th, that it says that. It says it's got to be now, otherwise we're going to have to go to the court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
April 26th, my apologies.
Yes. The court will extend your time to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I want to address just a couple of points briefly, if I may. With regard to this issue of previously identified experts or not, it so happens that two of the experts who executed the affidavits of merit also were eventually identified as testimonial experts. There is a big difference in the standard through which the expert can execute an affidavit of merit and then later express opinions to a reasonable degree of professional certainty based on all of the discovery, based on all the information, which was still being formulated into June of 2011 when we took depositions of persons who are employed in the defendant's offices and other fact witnesses. There wasn't any issue that we would not give dates for depositions. There were telephonic communications among the offices as we were trying to sort out schedules to give appropriate dates for expert depositions, as well as sorting out the experts who are busy practicing physicians. We gave dates. Some were rejected. Some came back, and they were eventually settled upon those that we put in writing to the other side. There were dates for depositions that were set that were canceled of fact witnesses in May because of unavailability of defense counsel. There wasn't this holding back by plaintiff's counsel or refusal to give deposition dates. With respect to the goings-on in February, indeed, there was an additional letter to the court, which was sent by Mr. Balaguer, because the initial letter by Mr. Gretto mentioned Mr. Balaguer's conflict with the trial date. After the letter order of the court of February 8th, Mr. Balaguer wrote back to the court on February 9th, which is A79 in the record, and pointed out to the court that it was his conflict with the trial date. He was scheduled for another trial in front of a different judge on the same bench, and that he wanted to make this clear to the court that he was not involved when the trial date was set. Despite that, there was no reconsideration. There was, and the very, very clear terms of the letter of the court of February 8th was that these dates will not be adjusted. And it was the consensus of counsel who discussed it later that there's very little we can do given this judge's proclivity for sticking on these dates, that, as Mr. Gretto told the court, a motion would be seen as even insubordinate and really wouldn't do any good. And that is why we sought the cooperation of defense counsel and thought we had it, and had it to a point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also take a brief recess.